It wasn't until April 12th of 1861 that shots were fired on Fort Sumter, the first shots of the Civil War. But this week marks the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the beginning. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On November 1st of 1860, it became clear that the secessionist movement of the southern states could not be ignored. Historian Adam Goodhart calls the day before that day the last ordinary day. His book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, will be released in April. He'll be with us today to talk about those first steps toward war. And Tom Moraine and Bill Yunke of Graceland University in Lamoni will help us understand Iowa's role in the Civil War. Iowa sent more troops per capita to the war than any other state. We'll talk about the politics, the battles, and the home front. Join us after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This spring, we will mark the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. Today, we mark the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the beginning. Later this hour, I'll be talking with Tom Moraine and Bill Yunke of Graceland University about the role that Iowa and Iowans played in the Civil War. And if you have Civil War heritage in your family, we'd love to hear your story at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's start on what my first guest calls the last ordinary day. That's the subject of an article by historian Adam Goodhart that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday. Hello, Adam. Adam, can you hear me? Hi.
Hi, good morning.
It's nice to talk to you.
Good talking to you.
Well, take us back to October 31st, 1860, what you call the last ordinary day. What was happening on that day?
Well, it's amazing when we think about the people who would become the great characters of the Civil War. Most of them were completely unknown at this point. Robert E. Lee was a colonel in the United States Army stationed down in Texas and spending his time thinking about fighting the Comanches and a Mexican bandit who was plundering along the Rio Grande. William Tecumseh Sherman was the principal of a military academy in Louisiana for teenagers, and among the teenagers at this academy were the children of a famous Confederate Civil War general, General Beauregard. And I think the most obscure of all at that point, famously, was a man named Sam Grant, whom we know, of course, as Ulysses S. Grant, living in Galena, Illinois, at the age of 38. He was facing a sort of a midlife crisis. He had failed in business, failed at farming, given up his career in the military, and he was working as an ordinary clerk in his family's leather goods store. And in fact, people who remembered him later as a clerk said that he wasn't even very good at that. So it was really...
And the legend has it he was drinking quite a lot.
Well, legend has it, and that's much debated. At this point in his life, it's pretty clear that he was not drinking. He was on the wagon at this point.
Well, how about Abraham Lincoln? Of course, he was president of the United States. It was just before the election. What was Abraham Lincoln doing?
Well, of course, Lincoln, as you say, wasn't president quite yet. He would be elected.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, he'd be elected in a few days. And,
slip of the tongue there.
No, that's all right. But yeah, we certainly think of Lincoln as a great president, as perhaps our greatest president, as an assessment that I would agree with. But we forget that Lincoln was, at this point, he was the most obscure person ever to become president. He literally hadn't been to Washington in over a decade. Throughout the campaign, he had stuck close to home in Springfield, Illinois, pretty much going to work as a lawyer throughout much of the summer, as he ordinarily did, and then he set up shop in the Illinois State House and would sort of receive visitors who came in, shake hands, smile, tell funny stories, sometimes tell dirty stories, depending on the audience. And what he didn't do was go out and campaign. He didn't give any speeches. We think of Lincoln as one of the greatest communicators in our history, one of the greatest orators. But during these months, these most crucial months of his life in some respects, he was completely silent.
What changed the next day?
What changed the day after his election?
Well, what changed after that ordinary day? Tell us about Election Day and how things changed.
Well, you know, it was a change that in some respects people really saw coming. It was fairly clear at this point from the electoral math. Of course, they didn't have Gallup polling or the other sophisticated assessments that have all kinds of people pronouncing today exactly what the results of the midterm elections are going to be before the first poll numbers start coming in. But people knew pretty clearly from the electoral math that Lincoln was likely to be elected president, and everybody was trying to figure out what they should do about it, what was going to be done about it. Throughout much of the South, the campaigners were already talking more about secession than they were about the election. There was a U.S. senator who was on the stump around Mississippi. He had been on the stump around Mississippi for about 6 weeks nonstop. And this was Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi. And he gave a speech on November 3rd, just a few days before the election, that's a pretty remarkable speech. He talked about what would happen if the U.S. Army tried to invade Mississippi, and he talked about he said that he would welcome the invader to the harvest of death, and future generations will point to a small hillock upon our border which will tell the reception with which the invader met upon our soil. So it's kind of amazing here, before Lincoln was even elected, here's Jefferson Davis talking about slaughtering his fellow Americans. Even more remarkable when you remember that Davis himself had been, not too long before, an officer in the U.S. Army and a hero of the Mexican War. So already some Americans are ready to imagine what might have seemed unimaginable.
When Abraham Lincoln was elected and this question of disunion became something that really could not be ignored, the secessionist movement really gathered steam and made a lot of noise at that point. Where did the question of slavery fall in this conversation?
Slavery was everywhere in this conversation, and people today who try to say that it wasn't are simply, I think, turning a blind eye to the past. Slavery and race, in fact, were present in every speech, every conversation that was held about politics at this time. And the racism is, even by the standards of the time, pretty appalling, the stuff that came out in this campaign. I should hasten to say that the racism was by no means all on the Southern side, nor was it by any means exclusively on the side of Lincoln's opponents. There were many people in the Republican Party, which, of course, was Lincoln's party at that point, which we think of as being the anti-slavery party, who were at great pains to prove that while they might have been opposed to extending slavery's bounds, they were not a pro-black party, and they said some pretty horribly racist things to prove that point. One of the things that I was sort of the most surprised to find as part of the rhetoric of this election is that a lot of people, amazingly, 140-some years before the election of Barack Obama, were talking about the possibility of there being a black president someday. And this became a sort of an issue, or at least part of the rhetoric of the campaign. People were saying, well, if we're opposing slavery, does that mean we're going to favor rights for black people? And if we favor rights for black people, does that mean they're going to have full rights as citizens? Does that mean they could even be president of the United States sometime? And I have accounts of people marching with banners in parades, with banners with a caricature of a black person, and underneath it said, "Future President of the United States." So it's kind of remarkable just how enmeshed race was in the conversation.
Let's talk about Abraham Lincoln's campaign platform, though. He did not, although he did issue the Emancipation Proclamation, he did not run on an anti-slavery platform.
Well, that's something that I think a lot of people have missed, and historians have missed some of the subtleties of that. Now, Lincoln was by no means an abolitionist. Like other Republicans, he took pains to make sure that people knew he was not an abolitionist. But there's a difference between abolitionism and anti-slavery, and that's a difference that was pretty clear to people at the time, but that we've lost sight of. Now, Lincoln and the Republicans were very clear on the fact that they were opposed to slavery and that they didn't want slavery to extend its bounds. They thought that slavery was something wrong and something that should be contained within America. Now, although they most of them were not ready to proclaim themselves abolitionists, it wasn't very much of a logical leap once the war started.
Well, we're going to talk in just a few minutes about some of the slavery issues that we were wrestling with in Iowa. Adam, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Charity. It's a pleasure.
Historian Adam Goodhart's piece, The Last Ordinary Day, appeared in the New York Times on Sunday. You can find a link to it on our Facebook page. Look for Iowa Public Radio. His book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, will be released in April. And joining me now are Tom Moraine. He's Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni and former administrator of the State Historical Society. And Bill Yonke, Professor Emeritus of History at Graceland University. They're here to help us understand Iowa's role in the Civil War. Thank you so much for being here, gentlemen.
Thank you for inviting
you.
Us.
I want to start where we left off with Adam, and that is with the question of slavery, because Iowa was really, in many ways, on the front line of that question because of its proximity to Missouri and to Kansas and Nebraska. Let's talk about the Missouri Compromise. And Bill, why don't we start with you? How did that question of slavery affect Iowa? And tell us about the Missouri Compromise.
Well, how it affected Iowa is a little less familiar to me. Tom is our expert on that. But the Missouri Compromise was in 1820 a way to keep the balance, and Missouri would come in as a slave state, Maine would come in as a free state, and the arguments that raged in 1819 were the arguments that would be on the table for until the Civil War, and so it really was raising all of the issues, and the question was going to be how will the new territories come in, how will the new states come in? Will they come in as free or slave? And it was early enough that there wasn't a great deal of settlement out beyond Missouri, so that one didn't have the fire that's going to be growing over the next several decades, and so it could be put off, and there would need to be and it would be talked about more and more, and there would need to be more compromises, and of course by 1860. That was not possible.
Right. Compromise had ended by that point. We'll continue our conversation about Iowa's role in the lead up to the Civil War and in the Civil War in just a moment. My guests now are Bill Yonke, who's a professor emeritus of history at Graceland University, and Tom Moraine, director of government relations at Graceland University. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this spring, we will be marking the beginning of the Civil War. The 150th anniversary of those first shots will be on April 12th this spring. Right now, we're talking about the beginning of the Civil War, the 150th anniversary of the election of Abraham Lincoln and the point at which it was clear that secessionists could not be ignored. My guests right now are Tom Moraine. He's director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. He's also the former administrator of the State Historical Society. Bill Yonke is also with us. He's a professor emeritus of history at Graceland University. And we're talking right now about Iowa's role in the lead up to the Civil War. And also we'll be talking about Iowa's role in the Civil War. If you have Civil War heritage in your family, maybe your great, great grandfather fought in the war and stories have been passed down through the generations, let us know. We'd love to hear your stories. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, Tom, let me turn to you. When Iowa came into the Union, it came into the Union as a free state. How did Iowans feel about slavery?
Well, picking up on what Bill said, the Missouri Compromise rather clearly indicated that Iowa was going to be a non-slave state. So if you were in favor of the institution of slavery, you were probably not going to move to Iowa because you weren't going to be able to bring slaves. You were going to find a hostile environment to slavery because from the very beginning, the laws said slavery will not exist here. Now, that there were some exceptions to that, and if you look at the record, there were some instances of slave owning in Iowa, but they were limited and they were sort of they were extra legal. So the advantage that Bill brought out on the Missouri Compromise is that it let people know before they moved what that legal status was going to, what the legal status of slavery was going to be. So we were rather self-selected by people choosing to settle here who were against the institution of slavery.
Although Iowa was not a state full of abolitionists.
No, we were not a pro-abolitionist position. Iowa passed some very restrictive laws governing blacks within the territory at the time, and we did not want to become a haven for black migration. That was one of the fears of any northern state. If they passed liberal laws, then they would attract black populations. So that Iowa had a not a good record in terms of 21st century race relations.
So, Bill, let's go back to you. The Missouri Compromise worked for a while, but it stopped working. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act is an example of a time when the question of slavery became very heated.
Yes, that's right. And by 1854, a lot of water had gone under the bridge, and one had a lot of settlement going out west. And I might have emphasized more, as Tom kind of picked up, that the key in the Missouri Compromise was there would be no more states come into the Union above 3630. So there was a all of that territory in the from the Louisiana Purchase was going to come in as free, and that was where Iowa would have been. Well, now there's a great deal of movement out west, and there has been the Mexican-American War. There's been all kinds of new territory that's come in, and the 49ers had gone out to California, and that movement west, and now decisions were going to have to be made as to what will happen there, and will California come in as a free? There were plenty of people for it to come in. Now, what about Utah? What about how would the territories be divided? And in the Kansas-Nebraska Act, there was an effort to revisit the Missouri Compromise, and in the Kansas-Nebraska Act, they opened up the possibility that Kansas could come in as a slave territory, and they would leave it up to popular sovereignty for the people to decide, and they thought that might solve the problem. Instead, it created more problems.
Let me chip in here, because there's an Iowa angle to the Kansas-Nebraska Act that generally isn't well known, and that is the first bill to organize the territory that was included in this, that would be included in the states of Kansas and Nebraska. The first bill to organize that territory was introduced by an Iowa senator, Augustus Caesar Dodge. I'd like to see somebody run today with the name Augustus Caesar. I think that's just sort of, I'd like to see it on buttons or whatever. Dodge introduced a bill to organize that territory. And he was in cahoots with Stephen A. Douglas, the senator from Illinois, and both of them wanted to see a transcontinental railroad that would go across the country. And the kicker in there, with both of them, of course, wanted to see a northern route on that. And the idea that it would come to Council Bluffs and then extend on into across Iowa to Chicago. There were Southerners who said, let's do a transcontinental railroad, but let's make its terminus St. Louis. And there were other Southerners who said, let's have a transcontinental railroad, but make it to New Orleans. So there was a political battle going on of where that railroad was going to be. Well, of course, Dodge wanted it to be to the north, along with Douglas, so they were eager to get Kansas and Nebraska area organized. And Dodge introduced a bill that did that whole territory as the territory of Nebraska. Well, Stephen A. Douglas knew that the South was not going to vote for a huge state coming in which slavery was excluded, so he had to get a way for the South to buy into that process. And the way he did that was to dangle in front of them, well, let's repeal the Missouri Compromise. Let's let the people decide. Whoever moves there, once they get there, they can decide whether it's going to be slave or free. And neither Dodge nor Douglas had any inkling of the negative reaction that that was going to create across the North of saying, we're going to open up the possibility of the Western lands going slavery. That was a huge miscalculation on their part about the tempest that would create. But Bill got the facts right in terms of opening up the land to the vote of the people. And let the people decide. It sounded good, but that meant both pro-slavery and anti-slavery people could move into the territory and then slug it out later. And that's exactly what happened in Kansas.
Well, it sounds like they were just looking for a means to an end and not even considering what might be the outcome of that.
Absolutely. And the end they got was not what they anticipated.
Well, let's talk about the tensions over, specifically over slavery in Kansas, because a lot of Iowans got involved in that struggle, didn't they, Tom?
Yes, they did. And Iowa, I liked your introduction that Iowa was the westernmost outpost of non-slave states. Iowa and Missouri were the ones bordering Kansas and Nebraska. And as it turned out, there were Iowans wanting to move into Kansas with the political purpose of making it non-slave. So Iowa became the route of settlers who had financial backing. We will give you guns. We will help you move into Kansas if you will move into Kansas and vote against slavery. Well, Missouri had the same interest in making it slave state. So Missouri was sending people across the border on election day in Kansas to vote pro-slavery. So Iowa becomes this leaping off point. The town of Tabor in far, far, far southwest Iowa, in Fremont County, became the gathering point for colonization of groups of anti-slavery settlers moving in who would go as a group in part for safety, but also as mutual aid society. We were a very important part in the colonization of Kansas. No one ever thought Nebraska was going to go pro-slavery. That just wasn't a possibility. But the proximity to Missouri, which was a slave state, made Kansas a toss-up.
You talk about moving guns and moving people. Was there actual fighting that broke out in Kansas?
Yes. Bill, do you want to take that one?
Just to state and somewhat the obvious, Kansas became known as Bleeding Kansas, and really in the aftermath of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, as both sides really organized to settle Kansas, who was going to get there first, who was going to elect the territorial government and make the rules as to what would happen. It turned out to be very contentious, and they fought battles. And there's one historian, in fact, who says the Civil War began in Kansas.
So in the East, there was a lot of talk about the question of secession. And, of course, historians, many, will point to the question of secession being the root cause of the Civil War. Although, as I talked about with Adam Goodhart not very long ago, that he says that the root question was slavery. How did the subject of secession play in Iowa, Tom?
Well, I think that there are many levels at which that could be considered. Obviously, the Iowans were not happy when the southern states started pulling out. There was no great love for them. I'd have to touch base here with a good friend of mine who recently passed away that many Iowans remember fondly, Richard Lord Acton, a member of the House of Parliament who lived half of the year in Cedar Rapids and half of in London. But he loved Iowa, and he loved to research Iowa history. And when he'd come across a question, he would very aggressively want an answer to it. And I can remember one time he practically pinned me against the wall, and he said, why did the North fight? Why didn't they just say, go away? We don't want you in. We'll go our way, and you go your way. And those of you who know Richard can imagine him getting quite animated about this question. And I've thought about that, because sometimes we miss that question about why did the North fight? And I think it's true in Iowa. I think it's across the nation. Sometimes I think we miss the idea and how deeply it runs in Iowa and in the United States that America has a special mission in the world. And in the 19th century, that was very strong, that the American experience was the example that the world is looking to, that free government, a government without an entrenched monarchy, can exist, can survive, can prosper. And the American experience and the importance of that for the world was deeply ingrained into the American psyche. I think sometimes we take it for granted that it's an entitlement, but in the 19th century it was something that most Americans thought of. We have to prove to the world that Republican government, small r Republican government, can exist. And even President Buchanan, who was a friend of the South, when the southern states started to secede, in an address he made, said, our example for more than 80 years would not only be lost, but it would be quoted as conclusive proof that man is unfit for self-government. And Lincoln, of course, talks about the last best hope of earth. The North saw the American experience as an example to the world that could not be allowed to fail. Yes, there were economic reasons. Yes, there were Iowans had everything to worry about if the South secedes and our main access to the ocean, to the Gulf of Mexico, is cut off by the South and we can't get our farm goods out. But beneath that, and that's when I think it's important to remember how important the success of the American experience in self-government is, and the importance of maintaining a union. I think we need to remember that.
Bill, when those first shots were fired at Fort Sumter, what was going on in the western part of the United States? And by west, I mean Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa at that point. Had the tensions simmered down a little bit by then?
I would say that they're reflecting the national anxiety about this, and I wouldn't say tensions had slowed down at all in the West. They, in fact, were going to be some of the greatest advocates of on the northern side, the Union, southern side, the Confederacy.
Tom, in April of 1861, how did the news reach Iowa that those first shots had been fired?
The newspaper system was pretty well established by then. There were national news agencies, and news traveled pretty fast. They got it through telegraph lines were starting to go up, but the news from the east would travel pretty fast. Newspapers were widely read. They tended to be partisan, that there were Republican newspapers, there were Democratic newspapers. It's like Fox News and MSNBC of the time period, and you got a filtered view for what it was. But when news like the hostilities have begun, that there is actual fighting, that spread very quickly. And I liked what historian Bruce Catton said. He said it was almost a relief to have the hostilities begun, because that tension of the waiting The North said, we're going to fortify our forts. We're not going to give up possession of the forts. The South said, you have no right to have national forts in our territory. We're not any more part of the Union. And that just sort of simmered. But finally, when the fighting began, it was almost, according to Catton, a relief that now we can do something. So I think that that rush to the arms came after 5 or 6 months of this tension of what's going to happen.
And did Iowans rush to volunteer?
Yes. The first response was a very, very strong filling of those volunteer ranks. But the anticipation was this is going to be over very quickly. They signed up for 3 months, and the expectation, I'm going to go to war, we're going to be victorious, I'm going to come home as a decorated war person, that was the thought of the war. As the war dragged on and the news of the carnage, and it was terrible carnage, kept hitting, then it became harder and harder to fill those musters.
Well, we will talk more about the soldiers that went to war from Iowa in a moment. My guests are Tom Moraine, he's Director of Government Relations at Graceland University, and Bill Yunke, Professor Emeritus of History at Graceland University. We're talking about Iowa's role in the Civil War. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the role that Iowa played in the Civil War. This is Election Day, and 150 years ago on Election Day, Abraham Lincoln became president, and in a short order, the country was split apart. We are marking that anniversary today, and we'd love for you to join our conversation. If you have Civil War heritage in your family, we'd love to hear the story of the soldier that went to war. Maybe it was your great-great-grandfather. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my great-great-grandfather did go fight in the Civil War, but our family lore is that he used it as an opportunity to leave his wife. So I don't know anything about what he may have done or not done on the battlefield. But Tom, we were talking about those first volunteers who signed up to go fight in what they thought was going to be a very short conflict. And I should mention that my guests are Tom Moraine. He's Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. And many of you know him as the former administrator of the State Historical Society. Also, Bill Yunke is Professor Emeritus of History at Graceland University. And Tom, as I mentioned, we were talking about those first volunteers who signed up to go to this, what they thought would be a very short conflict. When they signed up and volunteered, where did they go for training?
Well, training, they didn't get a lot of training. They got training in marching. They got training in moving into position in battlefield. Oftentimes, Keokuk was the point that they gathered. And if they think of the geography of the state, Keokuk is about as far southeast. It's about as close to the southern states as you're going to get any place in the state. So Keokuk was often the place they would form, and then they would be taken by boat down the river, sometimes to St. Louis, sometimes distributed then into the western army units. General Halleck was the commander of the West for most of the time. Ulysses S. Grant rose through the ranks in the Western front, but he did not start out as the commander of the Western armies.
Bill, tell us a little bit about the Western front, because I think when we get a lot of our Civil War history, we focus on what was going on in the East. What was happening on the Western front?
Well, the Western Front, as it would turn out, would be where most of the Union progress and victories were. In fact, one could argue that in terms of the entire progress of the Civil War, even more emphasis on the Western Front might have led to an earlier victory, and certainly more concentration on the West by the South might have assisted their cause. But one has a natural concern about the center of government, Richmond for the South, or Washington D.C., and who's going to be able to dominate those areas? And so there was perhaps over concern about that, and even in terms of committing troops and so forth. But the North would have wonderful victories coming out from the South, and they'd pile up and ultimately wind up cutting off when Vicksburg was taken on 63, cutting off four southern states, as well as capturing 30,000 soldiers, and really marking the ending of the war. Even though it was 1863, certainly the sign was on the wall after that.
Tom, you mentioned that after that initial rush of volunteers, it became harder and harder to get troops to go to war. Tell me about efforts to get more troops. There was a conscription, right?
Yes, and that's a way you get more troops.
Right.
You say you will serve. There were opportunities to buy your way out of service. When the draft was passed, you could either serve or you could pay a fee, and you could get out of service. You could hire someone else to go in your place. So it wasn't as democratic as the modern draft was set up to be. So there were opportunities to get out. But also, if you think about Iowa, we were a very agricultural state at the time. Almost two-thirds of Iowans on the census, Iowa males primarily, listed themselves as farmers or farm labor. And it's hard to leave the farm. The farm is not only an economic entity, but it's a family-run entity. And the removal of so many soldiers really hurt the agriculture industry and put a great deal of emphasis on farm wives, on the family structure back home.
Well, and Iowa sent a lot of troops to the Civil War. We had more troops per capita than any other state fighting in the Civil War. And the number I have is 76,534 men served during the Civil War. How significant was that in terms of Iowa's population?
I can't give you the 1860 population figures of that. Sorry, I don't know the census, but it was as you said the largest per capita enrollment in the Union. But that's in the Union. In the South, it was even much higher, and the estimates that 75% of eligible males in the South served, and one-third of Southern soldiers were killed. That's an enormous impact of the war, and I think in part because the Civil War is so ingrained into the Southern mentality, they had heavier losses than the North did.
Kate is on the line from Des Moines. Hello, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. So you had a relative that served in the Civil War?
Actually, two. One was Lieutenant James Horden. He actually was killed at Lovejoy Station. And his statue represents the Iowa cavalrymen. And these two gentlemen may know his history better than I'm ashamed to admit that I do. But he is representing the Iowa cavalrymen on the Soldiers and Sailors Monument. And then also my great-great-grandfather, Charles Cummings Horden, was a lieutenant colonel in the 2nd Iowa Cavalry. And if I can just take a moment, he wrote a beautiful speech that he gave at the 3rd reunion of the cavalry in Muscatine, Iowa, and I thought it was particularly important today on this election day. He tells them to go back to your home and your loved ones and to tell the children of the ties and the comradeship that bind them together. And he said to show no hatred or animosity for the men in gray who met us in honorable warfare, but particularly just in the United States. He said, teach them that we are one people whose aims and interests and hopes and fears should and must be the same.
Wow. Kate, how important was it to you growing up to know that your relatives served in the Civil War?
My father, John Brackway, who these two gentlemen may know, made it a point that we knew our history and the lineage and just how important it was. So I am hoping to pass it along to my own children as well.
Okay, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
And Scott is on the line from Mason City. And your great-grandfather served in the Civil War, Scott?
My great-grandfather did. It's like our family has got a generation missing. My granddad was too old to go in World War One. And he had a lot of first-person accounts from his dad, William David McGee, who shipped out of Dubuque through Keokuk and was with a cavalry unit, eventually rode with Sherman's group. And one of the tales that is kind of a family folklore is that he, when he got out of the service, he swore that he would never straddle a horse again, because it was just continual, and no one in the family ever remembers him riding anything except a buckboard. he was a blacksmith, and he had absolutely no use for straddling a horse again in his entire life.
Well, I think that's understandable. So, Scott, I'll ask you the same question. How important was it for you to know that your great-grandfather served in the Civil War?
Well, when my granddad was in his late 80s when I was born, and my uncles had enough foresight to get out the reel-to-reel recorder in the early 60s, and when Grandpa would get to talking about his dad, they would hit record. And so we've got hours and hours and hours of second-person accounts of the Civil War and what went on, and some names and dates and things that are kind of in the family history.
Wow, what a treasure.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for your call.
Yep.
Tom, you mentioned that a lot of two-thirds of the men who lived in Iowa at that time were farmers. What was the economic impact of all of these men going off to war?
Well, it was very diverse in the rural area. Sometimes the women became the farm managers. They had to make decisions about the farm. Sometimes they moved in with other family members. They would move in with a brother or a sister's family if there was a man there, or they would move if the wife was a young married woman. She might move back in with her father's household. The idea of a woman living alone on a farm, particularly in the frontier areas, was not well held, and also it was not socially acceptable to have a farm wife on the farm and have a hired man there who was not part of the family or to whom she was not married. That was beyond the pale socially. But the structure in the rural area, many women took on roles that they had not done. There was an ethnic difference. Those who had recently come from Europe had less hesitation about doing actual field work. American women generally thought it was beneath them to do manual work in the fields and would be more likely to resist it. But European women, Germans, Scandinavians, the Dutch, were quite willing to go out and work in the field when it was necessary.
And it also changed other aspects of working life in Iowa. I've read that there were many more women teachers during and after the Civil War as well.
Up until the Civil War, the teaching profession had been dominated by males, and often young males, and often young single males. And that was the recruiting category for the Army very heavily. So the potential school teachers were often taken into the Army. So about the only people left were women. What is interesting after that is that when men returned, women didn't give up their teaching positions. And as the profession became more and more professionalized, and it took more and more training to be certified as a teacher, men had other options, and teaching did not pay very, very well. It was seasonal, so it was something that women could do, but most men left the classroom to women. It wasn't simply women taking over. It was men abandoning the classroom for other occupations.
During the war, were there Confederate prisoners? I know that there's a Confederate cemetery in Rock Island, Illinois, which, of course, is very close to Iowa. Were there Confederate prisoners in Iowa as well?
Well, yes. And the idea that Confederate prisoners were only contained at certain places, no, there were informal arrangements, particularly all up and down the river as Confederate prisoners were being transported. There would be temporary areas for them. We did not have a major Confederate prison in the state.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I think we could go on talking about this for another hour or so. But after the war ended, how did life change in Iowa?
I can take one dimension for that. Politically, the state became very solidly Republican. There would be battles within the Republican Party, but the Democrats very, very rarely were able to mount a successful political campaign because Republicans were cited as the party of the Union, and the secessionists, the Democrats, the rebels, the Democratic Party got tarred as the party of the South. A couple things to note, though, that changed life significantly, that because of the war, there were other things going on during the war besides just the fighting. But when the Southern congressmen dropped out of Congress, who was left passed some things that affected Iowa greatly. The Homestead Law was enacted, granting 160 acres to anyone who wanted to settle it on public lands. The Morrill Act was passed, giving land grants to create agricultural and engineering schools, and Iowa State University came into existence. And finally, the North got its Transcontinental Railroad. And yes, Chicago was the eastern terminal for that because the Southern congressmen weren't around to veto it. So there were some major developments outside of the military itself that happened during the war, and we would see their consequences in the latter part of the 19th century.
Well, Tom, it sounds like we do need to do another show to talk about all of those changes that took place and how Iowa and the rest of the North and the rest of the nation moved into the future. But, Tom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Tom Moraine is Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni and former Administrator of the State Historical Society. And Bill Yonke, thank you so much for being with us today.
Shirley, thank you.
Bill Yonke is a professor emeritus of history at Graceland University. And thank you so much for calling and sharing your stories today. 13,169 Iowans died in the Civil War, most of those from disease, but still many Iowan soldiers served in the Civil War. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. Send us email. We'd love to hear your comments and questions, suggestions anytime. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk to some of Iowa's independent booksellers about the best new books on the market right now. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.